Hello, and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and surrounding villages. This is the News Extra edition for the week ending Saturday the 24th of November 2018. My name is Steve, and I'm the producer of this programme. In this programme, we'll have our roundup of news stories from this week's Hearts Advertiser. We'll also have our usual selection of good bits of national radio coming up in the next few days. After that, we have another in our series of Community Matters interviews with a local volunteer group. Then we have another In Concert feature, highlighting some of the musical performances coming up in the next few weeks. Today's music is called Just Enthralled and is by Goffby. And so to the news. And our readers today are Marion, Andy, Gabby and Pat.
Hello, this is Marion and my first article is No Excuse for Elder Abuse Campaign Running in Hearts. For this year's annual 16 Days of Action on Domestic Abuse, from November the 25th to December the 10th, a campaign is being launched in Hearts to raise awareness of how domestic abuse can affect the elderly. Run by Hearts Domestic Abuse Helpline, the campaign looks at how some elderly people may have been victims of violence for decades, while others who have become frail and dependent on help may be suffering neglect. They may not understand they could be being bullied into parting with money, signing documents they don't understand, or changing their will. In one case, a frail elderly man was abused by his own son. Age UK Hearts provided a domestic support service every week, which involved general cleaning of the house, laundry and shopping services. The elderly man lived with his son, who was his main carer, and there was no other care package in place. Over time, the domestic support worker gradually noticed how the elderly man's behaviour would suddenly change when his son walked into the room, as he was usually very talkative, but would become very withdrawn and quiet whenever the son was there. The worker also began noticing the elderly man was losing weight. When the worker asked his son about this, he became very defensive and asked the worker to mind their business. On subsequent visits, the worker would not see the elderly man as he had started to stay in his bedroom with the son, saying his father wasn't feeling well and needing to get some rest. The worker raised these welfare concerns and they were reported to the local authorities as suspected abuse. Following an investigation, the elderly man was placed in immediate respite as it was clear his son had been neglecting his role as carer to his father and his father was deteriorating very quickly. While in respite, the man significantly improved as he was given the care and support he needed. A long-term housing solution was arranged for him with a package of care and support. In another case of domestic abuse, a woman who is physically frail and unable to leave her home independently had become increasingly reliant on her neighbour for help. Her neighbour would help with paying bills, doing some food shopping and other related tasks. The elderly woman confided in a befriending volunteer from Age UK Hearts that she had given a large sum of money to her neighbour, who was struggling financially, and that her neighbour had also told her to pay the full cost of the garden fence they share being replaced. It transpired that regular sums of money were being withdrawn from the elderly woman's account without her consent or knowledge, and it was established that the only other person with access to the account was the neighbour, as she was given the bank card for the food shopping trips. The local authorities were informed, and through their intervention, Age UK Hearts set up a support network for the victim, which included a legal attorney to help with her finances, shopping, services, meal services and care package. Christine Roach, the chairman of the Domestic Abuse Helpline, said, "We want to remind people that sometimes the elderly are overlooked, and when it comes to talking about domestic abuse, which is why we are running the There Is No Excuse for Elder Abuse campaign. We are indebted to Affinity Water for a grant to enable us to undertake this important campaign, and also to Age UK Hearts, Hearts Independent Living Service and Hearts County Council for their invaluable support. If any of the above sounds familiar to you, then the first step is to talk to someone about what is happening. This could be a friend, neighbour or family member. GP or dentist appointments are also an ideal opportunity to talk privately to someone who can help, or consider talking to your social worker or someone from Age UK Hearts or your community meals service. For independent and free advice on organisations that can help, call the Hearts Domestic Abuse Helpline on 08 088 088 088 to talk confidentially to a trained volunteer. Equally, if you have concerns about a family member, neighbour or friend, call the helpline, which is open 9am to 9pm, Monday to Friday, and 9am to 4pm at weekends.
Hello, my name's Andy, and my first headline is Village Must Resist Swamp of Housing or Risk Losing Character. Historic villages in the south may soon be killed in a swamp of housing proposed to be built just over the district border, a councillor has warned. Hartsmere Borough Council, HBC, are currently consulting on including at least 4,000 homes on the Tittenhanger estate in its draft local plan. The Greenbelt site neighbours London Colney, close to junction 22 of the M25, and by Courses Road. Coined the Redwell Garden Village, the proposal includes a secondary school, 4 primary schools, cycle routes, 60% open space, new doctor's surgeries, and space for offices, shops and hotels. Colney Heath St Albans District Councillor Chris Brazier has called for the St Albans community to rally against overdevelopment by the border, warning it will kill off a historic settlement. He said, "The potential growth around London Colney and Colney Heath bordering on St Albans must be resisted. It would mean the loss of huge areas of greenbelt, the loss of woodland and potential coalescence between Shenley, London Colney and Colney Heath." Councillor Brazier noted that Welwyn Hatfield Borough Council is also planning to develop the former Hatfield Aerodrome. He said the emphasis must be on retaining local character, strengthening our shopping centres, securing economic growth, reinforcing neighbourhoods and creating new small neighbourhoods with the necessary infrastructure. There should not be a loss of character, an erosion of London Colney's identity, the loss of Colney Heath and Smallford as greenbelt settlements. Welwyn Hatfield need to raise the profile of the University of Hertfordshire as a cultural asset. Hartsmere must look at their plan again. Both councils should not be trying to change the borders and encroach into St Albans district. A county-wide infrastructure deficit will exacerbate any issues, Councillor Brazier said. London Colney Parish Council has also railed against the plans, distributing a leaflet to every house in the area outlining numerous negative outcomes to the HBC proposal, such as a gridlocked bypass and flooding from the River Colne. Parish Council Chairman Malcolm McMillan said, "Such a massive proposal will mean 20 years of disruption with detriment to the quality of our lives. Air quality will worsen and noise levels will increase. We are facing the biggest planning crisis in the history of London Colney." He noted development is also planned for the Park Street Strategic Rail Freight Interchange site and already underway on the Harperbury Hospital site. There'll be 2 meetings to discuss the plans, 6:30 on November 21st in the London Colney Caledon Community Centre and 7:30pm on November 29th at Colney Heath JMI School. A spokesperson from HBC said, "We are seeking views on potential sites for housing and employment for Hartsmere that have been put forward by landowners and house builders. At this time, no decisions have been made. This is the latest phase of public engagement for the new local plan, and we are encouraging people to get involved. There is a dedicated section about the new local plan on our website, which includes more information on the proposals and sites put forward for consideration." As part of the HBC call for sites, landowners also proffered 1,860 new homes in Radlett, including a 500-home, 35.86-hectare settlement to the northwest of Watford Road, and a 560-home, 41.6-hectare development south of the Ridgeway. She said the council will carefully consider all consultation responses after December the 20th. A spokesperson from Welling Hatfield Borough Council said, "We rigorously assessed all sites to ensure only the most suitable went forward for inclusion in our draft local plan. Part of this involves working closely with our neighbours and other bodies to plan for growth across the county, ensuring we deliver infrastructure improvements to transport, healthcare and other local services to support development."
Hello, I'm Gabby, and my first article is about Anne Main visiting pubs worst affected by business rates increase of up to 280%. St Albans MP Anne Main has toured a number of city pubs which have been badly affected by a business rate increase. Save St Albans Pubs organised the tour with Mrs Main to highlight how many were being put at risk by tax increases. Speaking outside of Yieldy Fighting Cocks, its landlord, Christo Tofalli, told her, "Unless we have proper reform and relevant taxes, licensing laws and duty costs, this pub is over. I have already pulled it back from despair once. I'm the only person in the last 50 years to spend any money on it. Our taxes have gone up to such an extent, I am personally funding this pub, and that's the wrong way round. We need your support, Anne." Mrs. Main was shown around many of the pubs, which saw an increase in their rates in 2015. The Blacksmith's Arms, which had an increase of 82%, the Beach House, 59%, the Boot, 280%, Dillon's, 32%, Yieldy Fighting Cocks, 60%, and the Six Bells, 87%. A discount, revealed in the October budget, gave a third off business rates for retail premises with a retail value below £51,000, but many St Albans pubs do not qualify as their rateable values are higher than £51,000. Business rates for pubs are calculated in part using turnover, a sore point for successful St Albans publicans. The landlord of the Boot, Sean Hughes, said, "I think the equation the government has used for pubs is wrong. It's like a turnover tax. The problem with turnover is there are different types of pubs, all with different profits." Save St Albans Pubs has come up with a list of reforms which could help them, including taxing supermarkets more to pay for tax relief for small businesses, and a third off the first £51,000 of the rateable value for all pubs, not just a sample. Standing next to a sign showing how the Fighting Cocks has seen a 60% rate rise, Mrs Main said, "When you see this, it's depressing. I am hoping you can make a coherent case as to why the model is broken and try and keep it on a particular track, because people do talk about taxing supermarkets, but that is a slightly different argument, and I need a distilled argument." She promised to put in for a debate slot.
Hello, I'm Pat. This is about the thousands of people who flocked to the city centre to watch the Christmas lights switch on. Around 16,500 people enjoyed the Christmas lights switch on in St Albans on Sunday. St Albans Mayor Rosemary Farmer flicked the switch on the clock tower lights while the city's pantomime stars turned on the St Peter's Street display. The District Council's portfolio holder for business, Sally Gazouche, said, "The lights switch on is a fantastic family event and it always generates a terrific atmosphere. This year we were lucky with the weather, as it was dry and sunny and the crowd seemed even bigger than usual. I thought the lights were excellent and was particularly taken with the stunning clock tower projection. This will all help to make St Albans a top destination for Christmas shoppers during the festive season, benefiting shops, restaurants, bars and the local economy. Councillor Farmer said it was lovely to join the bumper crowds for the start of the Christmas festivities in St Albans. The lights and the projection onto the clock tower looked truly fabulous, and it was wonderful to see so many people enjoying themselves. Several roads around the city centre were closed for the event, which started at noon and included fairground rides and live music. The lights, which were switched on at 5 p.m, were largely funded by St Albans Business Improvement District, BID, which plans to expand the display even further next year. BID manager Helen Burridge said it was wonderful to hear the crowd's reaction to the clock tower reveal, which will continue to develop and change over the coming weeks. Make sure you drop by the Cathedral Quarter to see it in action, and thanks again to Rewind for their time and generosity in making it happen. The lights did spark controversy on social media, however, due to a projection on the clock tower wishing everyone happy holidays, rather than referring to Christmas by name. Helen said Rewind is a local company that had offered to design a bespoke projection for the city. Planning application was given last Monday, and the message is intended to evolve and will do so over the course of the next 6 weeks. And there are some lovely photographs, one of the Happy Holidays light up on the church, on the clock tower, and one of a toboggan slide with a little girl looking very happy, sliding down it. And a little child called Molly Fielder is enjoying a ride as the lights switch on, plus dummy. And then a picture of the many, many people in St Peter Street all thoroughly enjoying whatever was happening and taking photographs and lots of balloons.
CCOS development. Major progress is being made on the most ambitious development St Albans Council has undertaken. Surveys are currently being carried out at the Civic Centre Opportunity Site, CCOS, South Site, which includes the former police and NHS buildings. The Council's portfolio holder for development, Julian Daly, said this is a multi-million redevelopment, the most ambitious the Council has undertaken. It has been years in the planning, and now the public will begin to see major changes with the dilapidated old police station and health clinic due to be demolished early next year. Before that can take place, however, a lot of preparatory work needs to be done, and this is the stage we are now progressing. This is a very exciting development. There is no doubt it will greatly improve an area in the very heart of the city that has become rather run down. In the new year, work will begin to remove asbestos, put up scaffolding, and then demolish the two buildings.
Huge support for city's first Christmas festival. Plans for this year's Meraki Christmas Festival have won the support of business organisations and individuals across the district. They have highlighted the positive benefits to the city centre for residents, visitors and retailers. St Albans Business Improvement District Manager Helen Burridge responded to the campaign to prevent the festival. "We're entirely supportive and proud of all the work Meraki do for St Albans, and we haven't received a single negative comment or concern from our 500 member businesses. The positive impact of the Christmas festival over 3 weeks would bring audiences, money and footfall to the city, benefiting our businesses and our community in what is an incredibly difficult trading environment this year. We are incredibly disappointed that no more than 10 householders have the money and time to use their energy to such a destructive and negative end. We are proud to represent over 4,000 employees in the city centre, and we will make our voice of positivity and festive spirit heard loud and clear." Alison Burney, Chair of St Albans Visitor Partnership, said, "These sorts of events attract many visitors to the city, which is good for the local economy, as well as providing festive fun for the local community. I know Meraki is working hard to make sure St Albans has a fantastic Christmas. We wish them well." The old Fighting Cock's landlord, Christo Tafali, said, "A handful of houses don't represent the community and shouldn't have the capability to hold back this festival. This is a community event and will bring thousands of people to the city at a time when we desperately need them. Many other local residents have already submitted comments in support of the plans. Pauline Gillingham said, "How, a few local residents, can imply the public park is an extension of their back gardens is unbelievable. And how such a minority can be allowed to threaten the entrepreneurial efforts of a small company trying to bring such a great event to the centre of the city for the benefit of the whole community is beyond comprehension." Kelly Constantine added, "I've just heard the ridiculous news that Meraki is not being allowed to host its whole Christmas fair in the park due to some complaints of people near the park. This is a public park designed for the enjoyment of the community, and the festival will be a massive bonus for St Albans. The park does not belong to these people, and I'm sure the Meraki team would do all they could to make it as least disruptive for them."
This article is about a call for more mental health provision for teens. A youth group is demanding more mental health counsellors in schools to benefit the well-being of pupils in St Albans. 8 members of St Albans Youth Council made a plea at a public meeting for counsellors to work within schools and help pupils cope with exam stress and other pressures. The youth counsellors, all aged 11 to 19, met with councillors from the District Council's 2 scrutiny committees on Tuesday, November the 13th. Youth Councillor Niamh McGrath said that every pupil could benefit from specialist help due to the intense pressure they are under. The young people also argued that having counselling in schools rather than outside would mean the pupils involved would not have to miss lessons. As well as demanding more mental health provision in schools, they called for efforts to tackle social isolation among teens by offering activities in the summer holidays and asked for campaigns to raise awareness about the needs of young adults with learning disabilities. Youth Councillor Ariane Canny said some young people become socially isolated during holidays and spend hours on social media or playing computer games. He called for the council to set up a focus group to find out what opportunities teens would like to be offered. Bethany Chan, another member of the Youth Council, wanted to improve young people's understanding of learning disabilities and help them gain insight into the reasons behind behaviour. The Youth Councillors also asked for an extension of the Young Health Champions scheme to cover children under 13. Youth Councillor Tiffany Ozibanyu said that despite the scheme having many positive impacts, there was strong evidence it needed to be extended. Mental Health Champion Councillor Anthony Rowlands, who chaired the meeting, said, "The Youth Council made an outstanding presentation and raised many important issues. Councillors at the meeting agreed we will now consider all the issues raised by the Youth Council and prepare a response, detailing the other actions we will undertake to deal with their concerns." The Hearts Advertiser has partnered with anxiety specialist Stacey Turner on the It's OK to Say campaign, which encourages people to speak out about their mental health. Stacey responded to the Youth Council's initiative. "If we look at a child aged 4 to 6 settling into school, often we can be assured that in time any anxieties will settle. However, many people don't know it's extremely common for it to appear at age 11 to 13 due to educational pressures and social demands. We absolutely need counsellors in schools understanding behaviours, not only guiding teachers appropriately in the best interests of the pupils, but to provide the support on this bumpy road, making an essential difference to the educational experience."
A 17-year-old girl from St Albans has been selected as one of 8 winners of Young Sport Person of the Year. Judo champion Amy Platten was chosen by OCS UK for a mentoring and bursary programme which will help her family support her through her training, travelling and competing. Along with the other 7 winners from around the UK, Amy has been invited to an event at the Oval this month, where one of them will be crowned overall Young Sportsperson of the Year. She has also been allocated an OCS mentor to provide ongoing support and take stories of her achievements back to the business. Bob Taylor, OCS CEO for UK, Ireland and Middle East, said the Young Sportsperson programme is just one way we support talent, and we're proud to be able to help these outstanding young athletes fulfil their potential. And there's a very nice photograph of the teenage judo champion, Amy Platten, smiling at the camera.
Fantastic feast. Cake baker wows celebrities with sponge. A St Albans baker's cake has been taste-tested on national television by famous actors. Sarah Pratt, owner of cake company Buttercream Dream, was asked to create a sponge to be eaten during a This Morning interview on ITV with Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald actors Eddie Redmayne and Jude Law. The vanilla Madeira sponge with raspberry jam was intricately decorated with a large book and presented to the Harry Potter spin-off actors by interviewer Alison Hammond. Holding up a slice at the end of the 3-minute interview, Eddie Redmayne said, "Best interview over." During the segment, the celebrities played JK or Joking, a game where they had to guess if outlandish creatures' names are J.K. Rowling inventions or made up by ITV producers. Sarah said this was the most exposure her work had received since she started the business. She added, "I was so nervous all morning waiting for it to come up, and I swear they did a tiny excerpt, a teaser, and I nearly burst into tears. I felt so elated, like I had drunk a bottle of champagne. It was amazing, just lovely on the day." She had been contacted by ITV on Friday evening and tasked to create the cake by Sunday for the show, which aired on Tuesday, November the 13th. "I was able to do something like that in 48 hours, but it took all day and all evening. It just so happened that I was clear and able to do it. It was fate." Sarah's son is a fan of the franchise, and they went to see the first instalment together at the Odyssey. "I think that really helped me because I was able to converse with the producers about the film and the characters and how it would work." After This Morning aired, Sarah's Facebook page has been gaining more traction, and Alison Hammond even sent Sarah a personal thank you. The presenter said, "Hi Sarah, thank you so much for the cake. It was the best thing and literally made Eddie Redmayne say that my interview was the best interview he'd ever had. He was actually eating your cake at the time." Sarah has lived in St Albans for about 16 years, running her business from home for 4 years.
Teen artists' Christmas cards of City Museum are flying off the shelves. A teenager who painted an iconic St Albans landmark has created popular Christmas cards of the designs. Aspiring artist Georgia Sweeney created the cards using a watercolour scene she painted of the facade of St Albans Museum and Gallery, and they've been selling successfully in the museum's gift shop. The 16-year-old is using the profits to prepare for university by attending summer art school at either the University of the Arts London or Kingston University London. She said, "It is really exciting because I thought it was really nice to have something I had done in a shop that is very St Albans, for and about the city. I like the idea of telling and expressing different stories of different lives and different places. One of the things I enjoy about my art is being able to create something of my own enjoyment that other people can appreciate as well." Georgia got the idea after winning a Christmas card competition of a different design at St Albans High School for Girls last year. With the help of Mac Pro Design and Print on Pickford Road, she made that earlier scene, also of St Albans Museum and Gallery, into cards to fundraise £4,000 for a charity expedition to Malawi. Her mum Phyllis Sweeney said, "I'm bursting with pride. Lots of people have put really nice comments on Facebook, and when she delivers them to people, they have been so lovely. It's so nice for her, and I am really hoping that she gets to do what she wants to do at university." She has been asked by quite a few people to do a calendar of a few locations, but with doing her A-levels, there is only so much she can do. Phyllis added, she's learning all about costs and marketing and business and other skills at the moment too. Although this work is in watercolour, Georgia enjoys sketching in ink and is interested in pursuing a career in illustration or animation. St Albans District Council portfolio holder for sports and culture Annie Brewster said, Georgia is clearly very gifted. She has captured both the building and the surrounding street scene brilliantly. I can see her pursuing a very successful career in art, and I sincerely hope she will go on to have her own exhibition at the museum and gallery one day. And there's a very nice photo inside the museum and gallery gift shop with one of the members of the museum staff with Georgia and her designs.
My next article is about a 19th century time capsule reburied with contemporary artifacts inside. A replacement time capsule has been buried in the same spot where a 19th century version was discovered last year. The original glass bottle was unearthed by Morgan Sindall Construction and Infrastructure in November 2017 on the site of the former Museum of St Albans under a commemorative stone plaque. It contained extracts from this newspaper as well as a Victorian halfpenny. A note inside explained the artefact had been buried by Dame Maria Millington Evans on July 20, 1898. She was an archaeologist, author, and wife of museum founder Sir John Evans. The developers have now reburied a new time capsule full of modern-day additions, donated from St Albans District Council, SADC, community group Look, St Albans, and Morgan Sindall itself. This includes a blueprint of the 10-home Oak Tree Gardens scheme, which has replaced the former museum site, and photos of the builders working on it. It was reburied on Hatfield Road in a ceremony attended by St Albans Mayor Rosemary Farmer, six of the new development's residents, and pupils from St Albans Gymboree and Albans City School. Portfolio holder for sport and culture at SADC, Councillor Annie Brewster, said, I'm delighted that Morgan Sindall Construction and Infrastructure has organised the reburying of the capsule and included items from 2018, the year in which a new St Albans Museum and Gallery has opened. Here is to hoping that in a century or so, people might discover the capsule again and get a glimpse through the decades at all of us. When the 1898 time capsule was discovered, there was also a second relic found on the site. It is believed to have been buried in 1960 when the stone plaque was moved. In creating the new Oak Tree Gardens development, Morgan Sindall has retained the Museum of St Albans facade to preserve the site's history. Area Director for the developer's Northern Home Counties region, David Rousel, said, as a company, we're very experienced at working within sites of historical and cultural importance, and it's a privilege that our team was able to have the opportunity to discover such an important and special artefact as this. And there's a rather nice picture of a group of people, and at the front is the mayor holding a spade, and she is flanked by some school children in their school uniform, two of whom are holding up the time capsule with big smiles on their faces.
This is a letter which is headed Shame of the Sofa. It's ugly, it's smelly, it's toxic. It's a danger to wildlife, and it costs a fortune to clean up. Are you missing a beige and brown lounge suite by any chance? I think I may have found it. Mind you, it doesn't look anywhere near as good on the verge by the side of Potter's Crouch Lane in St Albans countryside as it did in your home. As you begin your drive along Bedmond Lane, barely a mile away from St Albans city centre, and head off into the countryside, the bright winter sun drizzles down like honey on the brilliant green fields. It really is a magical sight. Soon the fields give way to a giant forest. It's hard to believe St Albans city centre is scarcely 2 miles away from here, and yet this is surely the real joy of living within breathing distance of the countryside, the powerful lungs of St Albans. Right opposite the giant forest, someone this week has dumped a no longer wanted beige and brown lounge suite. Perhaps it's because we move more often than we used to that we now have so much to dispose of. Or perhaps it's that everything we buy now is so very cheap and disposable. Perhaps it's the strict rules at dumps that are encouraging some people to dump their unwanted stuff rather than recycle responsibly. Whatever the reason, it's surely time to show our overwhelming disapproval. Surely it's time to make people ashamed to do these things. It's time that councils and law enforcement bodies got tougher and ensured people were more aware of fly tipping's disastrous effects so that we might get to see a much cleaner Britain. Let's show our disapproval. Let's let the fly tippers know it's time to stop rubbishing our countryside. And the letter is signed by Paolo Black, and there's a photograph of the dilapidated sofa cluttering up the countryside. Not a pretty sight.
Plungers Splashing into 2019 by Baring, Freezing Cold Pool for local charities. Brave Jumpers will splash into 2019 by Baring a freezing cold outside pool for charity. Tickets to join the 4th annual New Year's Day St Albans Polar Bear Plunge are now on sale. Plucky participants will throw themselves into the outdoor sub-aqua club pool on Cotton Mill Lane for the event, which is in aid of the Ollie Foundation, which stands for One Life Lost is Enough. Earthworks St Albans and the Counselling Foundation. Plungers who have ranged from 5 to 67 in previous years receive hot chocolate and a winter hat on the day. Spectators can enjoy food, hot drinks, musical entertainment, a raffle and a bar. Operations manager at Ollie, Verity Bramwell, said, "We are so excited to be a charity partner of the Polar Bear Plunge 2019. This is a great fundraiser that all the family can take part in and start their new year by doing something amazing for great causes. Fancy dress is welcomed and prizes are available. Past plungers have included a Ghostbuster, Penguin, Santa, Snowman, Giraffe, Buzz Lightyear, Superhero Banana Man and Pamela Anderson's Baywatch character CJ Parker." Earthworks leader Bianca Badham said, "We are excited to be involved with the Polar Bear Plunge again this year. It's a fantastic way to start the year with a running jump. We are currently piloting our Earthworks on Wheels project, taking our team into the community to provide a gardening service for vulnerable older people. The funds raised by plungers will help us to develop this service and make a real difference in the community. Since 2016, more than 400 people have taken part in the challenge and raised more than £15,000 for Hearts Charities. It was initially set up by North Pole adventurer Ed Sutty, who raised £46,000 for Rennie Grove Hospice Care, Earthworks St Albans and Cancer Research UK with the trip. The event will take place on January the 1st from 11:45 a.m. to 3 p.m. Tickets are £18 for adults, £5 for children, or £38 for a family plunger ticket. Child spectators are free, but adults are £8. And there's a picture of them all jumping into the water, wearing all sorts of fancy costumes. Oh, it looks freezing.
Here's an article from the short news items. The headline just says, "Eye test." A 94-year-old St Albans man has thanked a Hatfield Road opticians for saving him from a potentially lethal stroke. Kenneth Saff only had vision in his left eye since childhood until he began losing sight in his right eye for up to 3 minutes at a time. He visited Enhanced Optical Services and explained his problem, which set alarm bells ringing for opticians John Snellgrove and Anne Steele. John said, "Both of us thought this could be quite serious." Mr. Saff was referred to hospital, where a scan revealed a large fatty deposit in an artery on the right side of his neck. The hospital removed it within a couple of days of it being treated. Otherwise, he would have suffered a massive, potentially lethal stroke. John, who has 30 years' experience as an optician, said, if anyone has a sudden loss of vision, it is extremely important to follow that through. Mr. Saff later wrote to the opticians to say, you saved my life.
My next article is about a church farmyard event. Friendly farmyard animals are paying a visit to a church in St. Albans to kick off the festive season. Dagnall Street Baptist Church is hosting its Messy Church event on Saturday, December the 1st, with the help of Ark Farm, who bring farm animals into schools, children's centres and care homes. Families are invited to experience the bustle and chaos of the stable in the Nativity with some sheep, a donkey, chickens, geese, goats and a Labrador to keep them in check. After meeting and petting the animals, visitors can pop inside the church for a complimentary bacon sandwich, tea or coffee and a selection of crafts and games. Community Minister Jonathan Phillis said, we want to bring a bit of the mess of that very first Christmas to St Albans City Centre with an event for the whole family to enjoy. A warm invite is extended to all between 10:30 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. We hope to see you there. And then there's a nice picture of the animals, the black Labrador sniffing the ground. And on the other side in one pen are some sheep. And in the next pen are some geese and two black hens. Rather a nice picture.
St Albans District's hospitals could be left without vital medical supplies after Brexit, new data appears to show. West Harts Hospitals Trust, WHHT, revealed in a Freedom of Information request that its sole supplier for radioactive material isotopes is Euratom, which Britain is due to leave along with the European Union, EU. The British Medical Association has reported isotopes are vital for diagnosing particular diseases through nuclear medicine imaging techniques, treatment of cancer through radiotherapy, as well as palliative relief of pain and biochemical analysis in clinical pathology. Working outside of Euratom would reduce the reliability by which the UK can obtain these vital supplies, leave the UK increasingly exposed to supply chain risks, and restrict the ability of the EU and UK to share expertise. The Freedom of Information request was made by Peter White, Chair of People's Vote, South West Hertfordshire.
And that's the end of the news. And now the list of people whose deaths were announced in the Hearts Advertiser this week. Jeff Andrews, aged 66 years. Graham Brinsden, aged 80. Pamela Clark. Graham Day, aged 50. Gladys Davis. Bernard Foster, aged 98. Pamela Gale, aged 79. Paul Martin, aged 74. And Margaret Rogers, aged 79. Now, another little bit of our offering from Gothby, and then we'll have our selection of national radio highlights for the next few days.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights. We start with Saturday the 24th of November and a couple of Radio 3 programmes. First, at 5 p.m. is J to Z, which showcases some of the top artists appearing at this year's London Jazz Festival, international stars and emerging talents. Then, with a complete change of tempo, at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 3 is Opera on 3, Richard Strauss's Ariadne auf Naxos, starring Lisa Davidson in one of the composer's most celebrated soprano roles. over to Radio 4 at 5:30 p.m. for The Bottom Line. Evan Davis talks to an employment law specialist and asks whether the year-old Me Too movement has encouraged businesses to make changes in the workplace regarding sexual harassment and gender equality claims. Finally, for Saturday, 24th of November, Archive on 4 at 8 p.m. celebrates the music of singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell as she turns 75 and explores her impact on her fans and songwriting. Testimony from, among others, her former partner Graham Nash and former husband Larry Klein.
We turn now to Sunday, 25th of November. At 10 a.m. on Radio 5 is PNR's Politics. Tune in for an always interesting array of guests and topics and catch up on the latest Brexit news. Then at 11:15 a.m. on Radio 4 is Desert Island Discs. This week, Lauren Laverne's castaway is novelist Kate Atkinson. This will be repeated on Friday, the 30th of November at 9 a.m. Radio 4's drama at 3 p.m. is the second part of The Fortune of War, Patrick O'Brien's sixth novel in his best-selling historical naval series. Jack, Stephen and Diana escape from Boston in a rowing boat, taking a cache of American intelligence papers and stolen diamonds with them. Another best-selling author, Lee Child, joins Mariella Frostrop on Open Book at 4 p.m. on Radio 4 to discuss his phenomenally successful Jack Reacher thrillers. Then over to Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. for Drama on 3, The Unfortunates. Martin Freeman stars in Graham White's adaptation of B.S. Johnson's 1969 novel, in which a sports journalist travels to a strange city to cover a football match, only to discover that it was the city where he first met his friend Tony, who has recently died.
And now for a look at those programmes which are broadcast each day at the same time. Book of the Week at 9:45 a.m. on Radio 4 is The Letters of Sylvia Plath. The correspondence of the poet covers the period 1956 to the final days leading to her death. Repeated at 12:30 a.m. Also on Radio 4 at 10:45 a.m, the 15-minute drama this week is Maya Angelou, The Heart of a Woman. This is the fourth book in her autobiographical series, published in 1981, and covers the years 1957 to 1962, when Angelou first became involved in political activism. Repeated at 7:45 p.m. Composer of the Week on Radio 3 at 12 noon brings us The Women of Renaissance Ferrara, starting with St. Catherine of Bologna. Enjoy a host of music written by and for virtuoso women. Then at 10:45 p.m. on Radio 3 all this week is The Essay, Contagious Cities. Listen to five writers from around the world as they tell the heartbreaking stories of contagions that have taken hold of their cities, from HIV/AIDS in Nairobi to tuberculosis in London.
Now some recommendations for Monday the 26th of November. Chain Reaction at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4 this week has Catherine Ryan talking to fellow comedian Sarah Pascoe. The Radio 3 lunchtime concert at 1 p.m. is a recital from Wigmore Hall in London with violinist Ty Murray and pianist Silke Avenhaus, performing works by Grieg, Violin Sonata No. 2 in G, Philip Glass, Pendulum, and Saint-Saëns' Violin Sonata No. 1 in D minor. Then over to Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. for the drama Romance is Dead, a quirky comedy drama in which Lauren and Jamie would probably make a great couple if only he weren't dead. Be sure to tune in tomorrow, Tuesday the 27th of November, for the second and final part. Still with Radio 4 for quote-unquote at 3 p.m, stand-up comedian Phil Wang is one of the contestants joining host Nigel Rees for the quiz exploring the origins of popular sayings and quotations.
We now look at some programmes on Tuesday the 27th of November. 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4 brings Collecting the Troubles at the Ulster Museum. Peter Curran examines how a museum situated at the centre of Northern Ireland's troubles has begun telling the story of the conflict through arts and objects. Intensely moving, but also delivered with Curran's trademark wit. At 3 p.m. on Radio 4, in Short Cuts, Josie Long presents short documentaries about intertwining with another person, a father and son, for example, stare out to sea and talk about a lost love. A widow finds an unusual spirit guide for her grieving. Then at 4 p.m, still with Radio 4, is Guilty Architecture. Jonathan Glancy visits buildings in Nuremberg, Munich and the English countryside with a controversial history and asks whether they should be restored or left to crumble. Over to Radio 2 for Bruno Tonioli at the opera, in which the Strictly Come Dancing judge shares his love of opera. Tonight, the last in the series, he looks at goodbyes in opera. Music includes Puccini's La Bohème, Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, Wagner's The Flying Dutchman and Verdi's Aida.
On to Wednesday, 28th of November, and at 9:30 a.m. on Radio 4 in The Curious Cases of Rutherford and Fry, a look at how accents evolved and why they persist, repeated at 8:45 p.m. All of us have loved the books of Enid Blyton at some point in our lives, but of course there was a period when she fell from grace for sexist and racist language. So tune in to A Fine Defence of Enid Blyton on Radio 4 Extra at 1:30 p.m. to hear novelist Anne Fine explain how she was a product of her time, with readings from Miriam Margolyes and insights from one of Blyton's daughters. The drama on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. is The Victorian in the Wall. A Workshire writer discovers a Victorian man living in the wall of his flat. A comedy musical adapted from Will Adamsdale's hit stage show and performed by the original cast. A new series at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4 of Women Talking About Cars. This week, the always amusing Victoria Corran Mitchell talks to actress and writer Floella Benjamin about the role cars have played in their lives. Finally, for Wednesday, 28th of November, at 9 p.m. on Radio 2, is Bill Kenwright's Golden Years. The film and West End producer has a nostalgic look at the sounds of the 1950s and early 1960s. Pop oldies from rock and roll to the early Beatles recordings. Yeah.
We now come to Thursday the 29th of November. At 11 a.m. on Radio 4, Crossing Continents, this week is entitled A Stark Choice for Cambodia's Surrogates. Desperately poor women in Cambodia are promised $10,000 to bear children for parents in China. But they are arrested under new laws and now face an agonising choice. Keep a child they can ill afford to bring up or honour the surrogacy contract and face 20 years in jail. On Radio 3 at 2 p.m, Afternoon Concert features the first opera by Saint-Saëns, The Silver Bell. Impoverished artist Conrad is visited by a mysterious character who gives him a silver bell that produces wealth whenever he strikes it. But the gift comes at a terrible price, ... Or you may have been following for the past few weeks the drama at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4, conspiracy thriller, Trax Chimera. This week, Helen discovers the identity of the man she saw survive the fall of the Slate Building, and a dangerous relationship develops. This is followed at 3 p.m. by Open Country, which this week explores the area of the Suffolk coast that inspired much of Benjamin Britten's music and finds out how the composer's legacy is interpreted by residents today.
Finally, to programmes for Friday the 30th of November. Radio 4's drama at 2:15pm is the third episode of the comedy Holding Back the Tide. When Hector is thrown off a tour of Breck Howe, he decides to set up his own guided tours, a decision which tests Claire's loyalties to the limit. Then at 7:30pm, Radio 3 in concert comes from the Barbican in London, with an evening of First World War-inspired music. Includes a new work, Last Man Standing, by Cheryl Francis Hode, and Vaughan Williams' Symphony No. 4. Or, if you prefer, you may tune in to Radio 2's Friday Night is Music Night at 8pm, when Strictly Come Dancing head judge Shirley Ballas shares a selection of her favourite music, including Mambo Jambo and Soul Bossa Nova. She's joined by current Strictly winner Joe McFadden and professional dancer on the show Joanne Clifton. Another Strictly regular, Anton Dubec, reflects on his dancing years and recalls his Strictly leading ladies. And that completes this week's Radio Roundup.
And now, the next in our series of Community Matters interviews. Rob Pearman talks to Irene Austin of the organisation Hearts Welcomes Syrian Families.
It's about 2 years since Irene Austin came into this studio and talked about the work of Hearts Welcomes Syrian Families. Irene, at that stage, you talked to me about the way in which your organisation had taken up a challenge, which in a sense had been thrown up by central government when it said, mm-hmm. we as a country will take 20,000 Syrian individuals in family groups into this country. Not a very big number, but it's what we had to live with. Tell me how the organisation has gone on since then, because you've changed your aims a little bit. Is that right? Or the conditions have changed?
Yes, I think the conditions have changed. We started off very much lobbying for the county council and the local authorities to take on the scheme, which they did, apart from Broxbourne, who hasn't participated in the scheme and still hasn't. We started off as a lobbying organisation, but then when families began to arrive, our role began to change. So we now see three key aspects of our role, which is about welcoming, which is about supporting the families, and which is about helping with integration. As we developed, we also realised that although we'd formalised our constitution, and our constitution was not limited to just Syrian refugees, it was much wider. It was for all refugees in Hertfordshire that were signposted to us or that we came across, and asylum seekers if need be. We also decided that we needed to become a charity. So we registered as a charity in April of 2016. One of the things that has come up, that language is quite key to integration, and we were watching a very mixed provision and access to English language teaching across Hertfordshire, and we saw the role of the befriender and the language supporter as quite important. So in the first year, where the Refugee Council have the contract in 8 of the 9 councils, they put in befrienders, and we then said as an organisation we would take on that role from year 2 to 5. So we've been bidding for funds and a 1 year post for a volunteer coordinator to start taking on that.
Just tell me again the relevance of the 5 years there, because the programme of 20,000 individuals to be welcomed into the country was a five-year project that was spread over 5 years.
Yes.
Does that mean at 5 years after they've got to go?
At the end of 5 years, they will have to apply for indefinite leave to remain. And so we see at that stage we might be needed also to help with funds for that and the process for that. But they will have to apply at the end of the 5 years for indefinite leave to remain.
Now, you've brought with you a young man who's clearly got no language problem, speaks English fluently. Kerim, welcome. You have come to this area with the help of the scheme, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Me and my family used to live in Lebanon before we come to England, and it just became very hard for us to cope there after about 5 to 6 years of living in Lebanon. And my dad just thought that we had to leave. We didn't have any future there, and it was very dangerous for us to stay there. And he just thought that we had to find a way of leaving. And so we applied to a scheme brought by the UNHCR. I think it was a humanitarian protection scheme or something like that. After about 2 years, we got a call that our file was accepted by the British Embassy and that we were accepted to be resettled in the United Kingdom. And my dad was absolutely happy about it, and he wanted us just to leave and end up in a safe place.
Now, the safety is accentuated by the fact that Lebanon is not your home country. Syria is your home country.
Yeah.
You were born in Homs, and that's where your family came from, which was the beginnings of the standing up against the government, was it not?
Yeah, Homs was one of the first cities that started to protest against the government. At the start of the so-called war, it was more of a request for a couple of very basic human rights to be provided for the people of the country. However, the government didn't take it very easily, and the people didn't stop asking for their rights, because obviously in developed countries such as the United Kingdom, it's very, very basic for people to be able to say if whether they like someone in the government or not. While the president of Syria didn't like it, and the government sent their forces to stop that kind of protests and actions that were caused by the people. They called it riots, they called it terrorism. However, it was merely just people asking for their human rights.
And my guess is that you were aged about 11 or 12 at that point. How long did you stay in Homs after the beginnings of violence?
We didn't really want to leave. It was very dangerous, don't misunderstand me, but yeah, my family didn't want to leave until me and my other siblings had finished our education, or at least the current year that we were in. We spent about a year, roughly, with all the violence and the war going on around us. And we've seen a lot in that long year.
And then you went to Lebanon from Syria. You didn't know whether it was a holding stage. You didn't know whether you were going to stay there and go back. You didn't know what you were going to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, my dad used to work in Lebanon for about 20 years, I would say. He used to work in Lebanon since the 90s. So when the war started off and it wasn't very safe for us to stay in Syria, my dad just proposed to us to move to Lebanon or do something else. But considering that he was living in Lebanon and he knew what life would be like in Lebanon, he was like, come join me in Lebanon and we'll live here until the events probably stop or the country becomes a safer place, which was probably speculated to be a short thing. So we thought we'll go there, spend the summer after I finish my year seven, and we'll come back after for schools and everything else. And we thought we'll spend a good time in Lebanon during them 2 months. But then after 2 months, it didn't cool off. It just stayed going on and on. It actually escalated more and more. My dad wasn't happy about us to go back, but my siblings really pushed hard for us to go back and live our normal life as if there was nothing, even though all the violence was going on in Syria. They just wanted to go back to their home country, to their people, to their friends and everything else, their normal lives. We went back and spent about 10 days. My dad went back to Lebanon and carried on with his job and everything else. A couple of days after my dad left to Lebanon, the army just broke into our neighborhood and started shooting on people. They broke in with a lot of weapons, heavy weapons and light weapons. They came in with tanks and everything you would imagine. They shot at people, they tortured people in the streets. One of the scenes that I recall very distinctly is my dad's cousin's car being ran over by a tank. It was very terrible seeing that after the army left. And during that day, the army came into our building, which was owned by my dad and my uncles, and they searched everything. They humiliated everyone in the building that was there, and they more or less destroyed the flat and the apartments that the people of that apartment weren't there, and stole whatever they wanted. Yeah, at that point, my mom and my eldest brother thought, we have to go to Lebanon. We have to leave the country. So the very next day, they just called a taxi and we left the country. We fled the country to my dad with nothing on us, just the clothes that we were wearing, nothing else.
And so is this, I can say, typical, Irene, of the situation? People will be coming to this country, having been selected, if you like, by an agency which has said, here is a family that is vulnerable, one reason or another. And so they're identified, and the British system accepted them as one of the allocated number. Then what happens next? Do they tell you?
The scheme works that you went to Lebanon, but actually Lebanon became as unsafe as Syria because of Hezbollah and the militia.
Yeah, after the war started, yeah. It just became a smaller kind of branch of Syria because there are a lot of allies and militias that worked alongside of the Assad regime, the Syrian regime in Lebanon.
So under this scheme, you would have gone through a selection procedure. You would have been accepted. In the initial stages, it came to the Home Office, who sent it out to the East of England Strategic Migration Partnership, who sent it out to local authorities here to say, are there any local authorities who would take this family? And they would have given a profile of the family. The funding then came straight to the East of England later, and then the East of England would have approached local authorities, and the local authority would have had to say yes. They would have had to find the accommodation, and they would have received a certain amount of money from the government. And it is, you're right, a five-year scheme, but a decreasing scheme. So most of the money is the first year, then it reduces to the second year. They're hoping that some of the families after the second year would be independent. But if you're talking about a vulnerable person scheme, yes, the younger people are finding work, but not all of them are finding work. So there should be support, even if it's scaling down for 5 years. And in Hertfordshire, 8 of the 9 local authorities commissioned with the Refugee Council to provide the main casework. Decorum had their own team. So what we did as Hearts Welcome Syrian Families is we worked alongside the Refugee Council, and we're still working very closely with the Refugee Council and Decorum to see what support was needed and what we could provide. So initially, we didn't take any volunteers ourselves. We signposted volunteers to the Refugee Council, so I became a volunteer to the Refugee Council. Then as it developed and we decided we needed to take on our own volunteers, because after the second year, the volunteers befriended from the Refugee Council were being pulled out. And also we needed volunteers because we were planning events for the families, we were doing activities to help integration. So we have started now to take on our own volunteers and to organise DBS and all our policies and procedures. And that's really when we thought we need to be a charity, we need to be a proper organisation.
So my guess is, apart from your three targets which you raised at the beginning, that you're also looking for volunteers and you must be looking for funds as well.
We've got plenty of volunteers, actually, our website. And because we do a lot of talks, we're quite well known. We've spent 2 years linking with as many organisations as we can. So the volunteers keep coming in. We've got a good network of volunteers. We have enough funds to do immediate things, but for instance, we need a volunteer coordinator. She's only funded for a year, so we're starting to apply for funds again so that she continues. And we now have 41 families across Hertfordshire, and it is a complex picture.
As one of those families, Kelly, you were found accommodation when you arrived. Mm-hmm. What sort of accommodation was that?
I must say it was quite shocking at first, arriving in England and seeing the sort of accommodation that was provided for us. There was me, I was just turning 18, and my brother was about 23 years old, and they provided us with a flat with 2 bedrooms, and bedroom of me and my brother, it was literally, I would say, smaller than this studio. It was around 2 meters of width and 2 meters of length, and it had bunk beds, and I couldn't sleep on the second deck of the bunk bed as it was quite close to the ceiling, and I would hit my head every time I would raise it.
Well, it was designed for 2 small children. There you were, an 18-year-old and a 23-year-old, mm-hmm. in a bunk beds in a small room. If you would have been used to much better than that, much better accommodation where you were before,
yeah.
in your own home.
I have to point out one thing. I'm absolutely grateful for the effort and work that the Refugee Council and the organisation Hearts Welcome Syrian Refugees have provided since we've come to the country. And as for the flat, I'm really not blaming anyone because they have absolutely done an amazing work since we've come to England.
So you're in education full-time. I think your brother's at university already.
Yeah.
And you, I guess you're aiming for the same?
When I first came in England, I had already had a qualification from back in Lebanon when I graduated high school. But when I came here and sent it to verifying kind of sources, like, they said that it wasn't enough for me to go straight to university, so I had to do something else. They said I had to do A-levels, which at the time I didn't know what it was. But at first, the Refugee Council enrolled me on a language course, as my language when I arrived wasn't sufficient for me to go to university or to do A-levels even. And so I thought when I arrived, I have to graft for it. I have to do a lot of work in order for me to continue my education and not lose as many years as I might if I didn't have sufficient English level of English. And so they put me on that English language course when I arrived. And I finished it by June 2017. Yeah, I spent about six, seven months doing it. And then after that, I applied to another college, which is now my current college, Barnet and Southgate College in High Barnet, to do A-levels. And at the start, when I had my interviews at that college, they did not believe that I might have been competing to do that course. So they were like, okay, cool, we'll enroll you on this course, but we'll have you on trial for a couple of months. So if you weren't very competing for that course, you might be kicked out of the college or move to another course, which is easier than doing A-levels. So I thought, okay, fine. And I did that and I proved my proficiency thanks for the help from my teachers and everyone else. And now on my second year of A-levels, and I'll be applying for university soon.
What are you studying?
I do maths, physics and chemistry, and I'll be doing further maths as well this year.
What do you aspire to be?
I aspire to be an engineer. I feel like engineers help people. They make things better.
What sort of engineering do you want to do? You want to build things or do you want to make things? Or?
The kind of engineering I'm aspiring of doing is nuclear engineering, the engineering of smaller particles.
Dare I ask what sort of universities you're aiming for?
I used to think about it as a dream, going to Cambridge, but now I am really thinking it is a goal more than a dream, and I'm really thinking of applying to Cambridge. I don't know if I'm going to be accepted or even given an offer, to be fair, but I'm up for the hard work and I'll do whatever it takes if I thought there was a bit of hope or a bit of light at the end of the tunnel.
You did win a summer school in Cambridge. You were selected. There were only 38 places.
Yeah, from around the country. I was selected to go on a summer school in Cambridge. And it was such a unique experience. I really enjoyed it. And I thought, I want to be at this university. I want to study here.
And my guess, Irene, is that whether your organisation found this accommodation for this family or not, it's a two-room flat. They've got two young men, an 18-year-old and a 23-year-old, trying to do A-level and university courses in a room that's just about got room for bunk beds. What do they do? What do you do?
I have to say the Refugee Council has been very helpful. We have gone with the Refugee Council to the council to try and get alternative accommodation. We keep struggling. It's a really, really difficult one. We'll support them in trying to find alternative accommodation, but it's really the council that has to do that. And the Refugee Council has been writing letters. Anything we can do to make your lives easier, we do. We've helped your brother with money for travel to get to university. I'm now going in as a volunteer from Hearts Welcome Syrian Families. You know, we'll help you with personal statements and helping the family as well by talking and befriending, and that's all we can do.
Does each family have a volunteer for them?
We're trying to make sure that we have volunteers doing different things for the families. So the aim is that each family should have a language support befriender. It's a learning process for both of us. I'm learning a lot about Syria. I'm learning a bit of Arabic from your parents. We laugh together. It's conversation. It's that befriending, supporting that is so important. One of the problems we're encountering in St Albans is that the rents are very high. And so that after 2 years, the families are, not all of them, having to look for alternative accommodation. And that is a little bit unsettling because you've just begun to settle in the place you're at. You know you can't afford the rent, so you're going to have to move. So that's an area of concern at the minute for our organisation. You know, we can't help with the rent because we haven't got those sort of funds, but we've just put out an appeal for landlords, if there are landlords willing to rent properties to refugee families. And this council is very good. They will provide an incentive for that, but the properties have got to be found. So we are looking for philanthropic landlords and we're hoping, you know, some will appear.
Karim and his brother are only just beginning their route through the world, but their parents came from an established situation where they had jobs, they had home, they had everything. And then when they arrive in a different country, it's very tough.
I think it's been very tough for your mum and dad English. Mm-hmm. And also your father had a very good job as a carpenter. But here, to try and get a job as a carpenter, you need a good level of English. You need tools. You need a car. He has not found it easy, has he? And they've really worked hard at their English. The language they've achieved in 2 years is impressive. So we really want to continue to provide support to the families here and other refugees and asylum seekers. And we really want to respond, to keep liaising and talking to the families and saying, what do you see are the needs? And how do you want to see us as an organisation develop? And to provide this language support, a really vibrant language support, befriender, volunteer network. We think that is so important. So we need help with premises. We need help with people organising an informal tea, an informal lunch. We are thinking about a volunteer driver scheme. We are trying to establish that. It's quite a difficult one across a whole county. That's why our local groups are becoming more important, and people helping in those local groups, and to keep linking the families with other English groups. And for that, we need money and we need to encourage other groups to help with this and relying on volunteers to help us. Those are our priorities.
Great, Irene. Thank you very much. And thank you ever so much, Karim. It's really fascinating and I appreciate your time and your commitment.
Thank you.
And I wish you great success.
Thanks.
And now, in concert, David Arson tells Jill Burridge about some of the musical performances happening in the area in the next few weeks.
Hello, it's Jill Burridge here, and I'm joined, as usual, for our musical preview by David Arson. And hi. Today we're going to look ahead to, well, Christmas concerts galore, I think
I think that's right.
But just to start with, a reminder about this Saturday, which is the 24th of November, and something we did mention in our musical preview last time, but worth a reminder.
We did. It's a concert called The English Revival. And it's all English music, William Byrd, Orlando Gibbons, Charles Stanford and Vaughan Williams. But there's also some lovely clarinet music in it, and I thought it'd be nice just to have a little flavour of that. Gerald Finzi wrote 5 bagatelles for clarinet, and this one, the beginning of this one, is called Carol, so I thought it might set us off nicely today.
Part of Gerald Finzi's Carol, which is one of his bagatelles. That will be part of the concert this coming Saturday on the 24th of November. It's performed by Carillon, and they're going to be at St John's Church in Harpenden, and the concert starts at 7:30. Now, Sunday afternoon, which I know will appeal to many of our listeners because, you know, you don't have to go out in the dark and you get home before, hopefully, it gets dark. So that's Sunday, the 25th of November. St. Stephen's Church Hall is the venue for a Sacco tea concert?
Yes, Sacco, sorry, the shorthand. Sacco is St. Albans Chamber Opera.
Oh.
And the Chamber Opera puts on a series of concerts on Sunday afternoons, a tea concert. So if you turn up at 2:30, you can have a cup of tea and a homemade cake. And then listen to the young tenor, on this occasion, the young tenor, Peter Martin, who's singing Schubert's Die Schöne Müllerin. This is the lovely Mill Maiden, a song cycle about the life of a young man, Schubert's setting of the poetry of Wilhelm Müller, which is why it's called Die Müllerin. And then on Wednesday, at St. Peter's Church, lunchtime concert, Lynn Arnold will play Mendelssohn and York Bowen. She's really well worth hearing, a brilliant young pianist, and you're provided with a drink and a snack after the concert in the Octagon. The concert starts at 1 o'clock and it lasts for about an hour, and that's on Wednesday lunchtime.
And you don't have to pre-book tickets for either of those, do you?
No, that's good.
So that's Sunday the 25th of November, Peter Martin singing at St. Stephen's Church Hall, 2:30. And it starts actually at 3, but you can have your cup of tea first. And Wednesday the 28th of November, Lynn Arnold will play the piano at St. Peter's Church in St. Albans at 1 o'clock. So that's a sort of lunchtime concert.
Right.
Then we head on to the first of our many carol concerts, really. So Saturday the 1st of December, and this is Voix de Vivre.
Yes, this is not really a carol concert, this one.
Isn't it?
They're still to come.
Right.
Saturday the 1st of December sees two local groups, the choir of Voix de Vivre and the chamber orchestra Amadeus, are going to combine in what looks like a really good concert. The Amadeus are playing Bach's third Brandenburg Concerto, and the choir are singing Benjamin Britten's Sacred and Profane. This is a setting of 8 medieval lyrics written in 1975 for the Wilby Consort, which was directed by Britten's partner, the tenor Peter Pears. It's fiendishly difficult to sing because both the notes and the words, which are medieval English, are not exactly familiar. I've sung it once and it's really tricky. Much better known, however, is the wonderful Dixit Dominus by Handel, in which the two groups combine. It was one of the first choral pieces that Handel wrote. He wrote it at the age of 22. He was in Rome at the time. And it's full of youthful, fresh energy. A wonderful piece. Setting of Psalm 110. And here's just a little bit from the Gloria.
Part of the Gloria from Handel's Dixit Dominus. That'll be part of the concert on Saturday the 1st of December. Voix de Vivre with the Amadeus Chamber Orchestra. And that concert is in St. Saviour's Church, which is on Sandpit Lane in St. Albans. And I assume it's 7:30 start, that one.
It is, I think, yes.
Then we do go on to the
selection. We do lots of carol concerts.
Carol concerts.
With one exception, which will come to separately.
Yes,
Christmas upon us once again, many carol concerts in St. Albans and Harmondon. What is the attraction of carols? Why do they make us feel Christmassy, if indeed they do? Part of the answer is tradition, of course. We like things that are predictable and regular, like birthdays. And music plays such a large part in our lives, whether we are conscious of it or not. I'm sure you'd notice if you went through a whole day without any music, either on radio or television. Music has always been part of life, celebration, ceremonial, entertainment, mood music. And the choice nowadays is amazing. You can hear any sort of music you want just at the touch of a button. And this familiarity, I don't think, has brought contempt. I mean, music's just too important to us. Now, carols originally were music to dance to. And that's why many of them have refrains and are rhythmic and lively. Most carols were not originally composed as carols. Many were not composed at all, and many did not begin life with the words that they have now. Some didn't have words at all, and some started as just folk music. Lots of them come from Europe or America, and it wasn't until the 16th century that the word carol is used at all, and it meant a song with a seasonal connection, not necessarily Christmas, it could mean Easter. In 1504, there appeared a Corpus Christi carol, and composers like William Cornish and William Byrd wrote pieces that they called carols. Now, during the Reformation, the Protestants reclaimed secular songs, for as Luther is supposed to have said, why should the devil have all the good tunes? And so secular music became much more part of church music. Now, in the 17th century, a more severe form of Protestantism took hold in England, and the Puritans even tried to ban Christmas, would you believe? This was not an attempt to ban people having fun. It was merely an extension of the banning of saints' days and elaborate ritual. And the jollity, of course, came back with the Restoration and Charles I, and lots of songs then about drinking and eating, wassailing and dancing and having fun, and became very popular. So there are lots of carol concerts for you to choose from, which we'll mention in a minute, whether you like large choirs and big crowds, like the Bach Choir in the Cathedral, or something on a smaller scale, the Fairfax Consort in St Mary's Marshalswick. Just before we start on carols, if I just might mention one other concert, which is on Wednesday the 5th of December, the Wilson Quartet at St Peter's Church is another lunchtime concert. You don't often get the chance to hear recorder consorts. You tend to associate the recorder with school music, but there are many fine recorder players around, and also much more music than you might suppose for the instrument or groups of them. The recorder has a family, like saxophones or viols, descant, treble, tenor and bass, and here's a chance to hear music written for such a group. And it's by no means all ancient music. There's quite a lot of music written for recorders now. But here's a little flavour. Here's a piece by Gabrielli for a recorder consort.
Piece by Gabrielli. Is that going to be part of the lineup?
I don't think so, no. But,
no.
But it just
gives you a nice flavour, doesn't it?
Yes. There is some wonderful music for the recorder and really well played. It's a wonderful instrument.
So Wilson Quartet are performing at St Peter's Church in St Albans, 1 o'clock start again, and that's on Wednesday the 5th of December. Then right. When we get to the following Saturday, that's the 8th of December, off we go with St Albans Bach Choir.
Yes, I could just stick one in on Tuesday the 4th of December. The Hertfordshire Chorus and the Bishop's Hatfield Girls' School Choir are also doing a carol concert in St Albans Cathedral. But the cathedral has, you know, endless carol concerts on Christmas. So, starting with the Bach Choir, that's on the 8th of December, Bach Choir and Embassy Brass, and they do two shows. They do one in the afternoon at 3 o'clock, which is more
children, isn't it?
Mm. And then one at 7:30 for adults in the evening.
Mm.
Then that night, same night, Saturday the 8th of December, the St Albans Chamber Choir is doing a concert in St Peter's Church of Renaissance music. Now, 16th, 17th century music by composers such as Josquin des Prez, Palestrina, Gabrielli and Michael Praetorius. It's a programme of what's called polychoral music from Europe. Don't let that put you off. Polychoral simply means, just as polyphony means poly, many, phony sounds. Polyphony is many sounds. Polychoral means many choirs, so it's just lots of different parts. And because the forces required for this music, you don't often hear. Here's an opportunity to hear some really interesting music performed locally. So that's Saturday the 8th
of December. That's St Albans Chamber Choir at St Peter's Church in St Albans, 7:30. It's called a Renaissance Christmas. And then the following day, St Albans Choral Society are performing at Marlborough Road Methodist Church in St Albans. That starts at 7 o'clock, doesn't it?
It does.
But I guess you don't always know what you're going to hear when it's a Christmas celebration or a carol concert.
You don't, but I can tell you a bit about the next one, which is Wednesday the 12th of December, which is the Fairfax Consort at St Mary's Marshalswick. The Fairfax Consort is only 8 voices, and this is a programme...
And you're involved.
And I'm involved. This is a programme of readings for Christmas and music for Christmas, and there is a sort of blend of traditional, plenty of traditional stuff. The audience can join in and have a sing if they feel like it. And also one or two slightly out of the way pieces, but mostly recognisable as traditional Christmas music, which I think you'd probably enjoy.
Yes, absolutely. So that's Wednesday, the 12th of December. 8 o'clock starts.
Yep.
It's the Fairfax Consort at St Mary's Church in Marshalswick, which is on the quadrant.
Yeah.
Moving on to the next Saturday, which is the 16th of December, Harpenden Choral Society are then doing a concert in the Cathedral again, aren't they?
At 3 o'clock. Yes, in aid of the Hospice of St Francis. I'm sort of... have a link with this concert as well, because as it happened, I rehearsed the Choral Society, the Harpenden Choral Society, last night doing this music. I'm not actually conducting the concert, but I went and did the rehearsal because I'm the president of the choir. Right. They've got two. They're doing one in the cathedral on Saturday the 16th and then a later one on Tuesday the 18th. We'll come to that in a minute.
Yes. So that's the Harpenden Choral Society. St Albans Cathedral is the venue, 3 o'clock start, and the concert is in aid of Hospice of St Francis. And the following day, Sunday, the 16th of December, over at Hatfield at the de Havilland Concert Hall in the Western Auditorium, the de Havilland Philharmonic are doing a sort of seasonal thing.
They are. An orchestral concert in the Western Auditorium. And it will include live painting by James Mayhew, so you can actually watch him paint at the same time as you listen to the music, which I think is a fantastic idea. Mm. The title of the concert is The Nutcracker and the Mouse King. And the music will, of course, include Tchaikovsky's Evergreen Nutcracker Suite. There are two shows, one at 2:30 and the other at 4:30. The title of the concert is also the title of E.T.A. Hoffmann's story on which the ballet is based, and that in turn was based on the story of A Nutcracker by Alexandre Dumas. The first performance of the ballet, you might be surprised to hear, was not a great success. It was paired with Tchaikovsky's last opera, Iolanta. Must have been a very long night at the theatre, at the Mariinsky Theatre in St Petersburg. But Tchaikovsky wrote a 20-minute orchestral suite of music extracted from the ballet score, which was much more successful. There's a rather strange story about The Nutcracker, because after the success of The Sleeping Beauty in 1890, Tchaikovsky wrote The Nutcracker in 1982, a couple of years later. And amazingly, it was written to a set of very detailed instructions from the director of the theatre, the number of pieces, the number of bars there had to be in each piece, the mood of the piece, the tempo, and even the number of bars in each piece. Now, it's very difficult to imagine Tchaikovsky working within such sort of strict parameters. But as we know, the music was fantastic. The completion of the ballet was interrupted because Tchaikovsky went to conduct concerts for the opening of the Carnegie Hall in New York, and some of it was written in Rouen. And it had a rather rocky start, the ballet. Came to this country in 1934, I think was the first performance, and then from the 50s onwards it's become very, very popular, particularly at Christmas time. So here's a little excerpt from the Nutcracker Suite to remind you of how wonderful the ballet music is. This is the Russian Dance.
Part of the Russian dance from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker. And that will form part of the concert, two concerts, given by the de Havilland Philharmonic Orchestra over at Hatfield's Western Auditorium in the University Precincts. Sunday the 16th of December, the first concert is at 2, and then the following concert is at 4:30 in the afternoon. I would imagine you probably need tickets for that, because it'll be very popular,
wouldn't it? Possibly, yes.
Worth checking,
isn't it? Worth checking, yes.
And then Monday, 17th of December, the Harding Choir are in Harpenden performing.
In St John's Church, and this is another, it's called Wassail, and there's another carol concert, so I'm sure it'll be a combination of traditional and stuff for the audience to join in as well.
And when you say Wassail, because I always thought, are Wassails carols?
Wassail, I think, was to do with drinking. Mm. I think you had a wassail cup.
Oh, that's
and,
right.
And you went around at Christmas and you sort of cheers to everybody.
Yes.
So there's a carol called Wassail, which is about drinking, I think.
It is, isn't it?
So yes. They're all very sort of very festive.
Absolutely. And then on to Tuesday, the 18th of December. This is the second concert of the Harpenden Choral Society, isn't it?
Yes.
So that's in Harpenden this time.
In the High Street Methodist Church at 7:30. And then one more, Sunday the 23rd of December, the Lee Singers are in the public halls at Harpenden, and they have a very traditional, you know, mulled wine, mince pies type
So there's
Christmas
basically there's a concert nearly every night. If
there
you
is,
want to
there
sing
is.
Carols
you certainly,
from start to finish of December.
Yes, you're spoilt for choice.
Well, not till the finish of December, because once the 23rd is over, then you'll have to sing your own Christmas carols over the actual Christmas period. But just lastly to mention, and something that's always extremely popular, is the New Year's Day concert at the Abbey. This is a bit of a tradition, isn't it?
It is, it is. The St Albans Symphony Orchestra, there's a sort of traditional New Year's Day concert in the Musikverein in Vienna.
Yes.
But St Albans has its own one. The St Albans Symphony Orchestra gives a concert in the cathedral on the evening of, in this case, Tuesday, the 1st of January. And they've called it Strictly Dancing and Mostly Movies. And it contains music by Strauss, the Gypsy Baron Overture, and, of course, the Blue Danny Waltz, Prokofiev, excerpts from Romeo and Juliet, Massenet, ballet music from El Cid, Arnold, The Bridge on the River Kwai, and John Williams' Raiders of the Lost Ark. And we thought that it would be suitably festive, if not terribly Christmassy, to have a little excerpt from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
You can bet your bottom dollar that'll be on television at some stage over Christmas.
I'm pretty sure it will.
Watch it for the nth time.
Yes, it will.
Raiders of the Lost Ark, which form part of the concert by St Albans Symphony Orchestra in the Cathedral, 7 o'clock start, Tuesday the 1st of January. And I do know that that is often booked out. So you need to get your tickets beforehand.
I think that would be advisable, yes.
Absolutely. Okay. Yes. Well, in the meantime, thank you very much, David, for joining today to have a canter through the carols. And happy Christmas to one and all listening.
Indeed.
And we'll look forward to being back, I think, towards the end of January, when we'll take a look ahead to non-Christmas
Indeed.
Concerts.
Indeed.
Finally, we have our piece of music, Just Enthralled by Goffby, in its entirety. Many thanks to all our readers today, to Angela, who provides the radio listings, and to Monty and John, who make all the copies of the programme and arrange to get yours to you. and we'll be back again next month. But that's all from News Extra in November 2018. Goodbye.